Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 10, Freedom of Asceticism.
See, like when you become a monk or a nun in a Buddhist country, is you're not punishing yourself at all. You're rewarding yourself. And the society is intelligent enough to reward you because why? You realize that, wow, I am, the event that is me is this fantastic process capable of achieving permanent and total happiness. And in the Theravada, you don't really add too much and then helping all others to achieve it. You just say, and then at least not harming anybody else and being completely free, setting an example of others to be free, maybe sharing that ability or knowledge with others. And I have this opportunity, so I don't want to spend any time doing anything that leads only to, like, you know, livelihood or clothing or houses or anything. So I don't need any house. I don't need to make any money. I don't need to do anything except focus on this liberation quest. And wow, I live in a society where enough people have achieved that, where they're enlightened and they're generous enough, and they feel there's this possibility for them as well, although they may not be ready for it, so they're working and storing food and doing what they do. But they're happy to share this with someone seeking that enlightenment. So I just, you know, to show my sincerity, I shave my head. I take off my shirt and put on an orange robe, usually in some countries, different colors in different countries, depending on what plant dyes they have plentifully. In India, it was a saffron orange robe. And I go get free lunch from all the happy people who are happy to give it to me. Because they see, at least I can't quite use my precious human life in that way, because I've got these children, I have these duties, I have this thing, and I have to work, but I'm growing things and earning things, but I have something to help you do that. And then I make it with the prayer that in the future I'll be able to become enlightened too, and I hope you get enlightened soon. And also I just like you, because we like someone, because we are like total slaves, you know. We're slaves. I can't tell you my day. I had like 19 meetings today. Faculty, administration, students, classes, phone calls, asylum cases, some poor Tibetan trapped in Elizabeth, New Jersey, you know, having to talk to him and prove to the judge that he comes from Tibet and all this kind of thing. I mean, all day long. I'm a slave. So when they meet someone who's like seeking freedom and is dropped out of all kind of social duties and gets free lunch, and doesn't have a big wardrobe to worry about, it's got like one orange robe, and doesn't even bother with underwear. Peaceful and quiet, not worried about getting a date, nothing. All sublimated, all their eros, and they're feeling just blissful. Have a lunch, and like sit down, like what are you thinking today, what's happening? You know, the slave feels a moment of freedom. They feel a person who radiates like a little calm and blissful feeling. So then they really value those people, and they're happy to give them the free lunch and hang out with them and say, well, what's the story about this and that, you know? And so it's not at all a punishment to be a renunciant. It's a privilege. And it's recognizing the person, recognizing their own value, really, and really esteeming themselves. Why should I waste my time making money and then I'll die? And who gets the money? Fighting a war for some moron to have an oil well on? Killing others, getting killed, lowering my evolutionary future for some moron? Okay, so that's the Theravada. Now, the Mahayana, second vehicle, is totally built on that foundation. That you will have read, if you've been reading about Buddhism, or you might have heard that there's a big opposition between Theravada and Mahayana, between the individual vehicle and the universal vehicle, and that is simply not true. The universal vehicle is built on the foundation of the individual vehicle. When individualism became more well established, where it was kind of unquestionable, because social authorities do not easily give out free lunches. They do not allow manpower or womanpower to leave the armies and the kitchens and the fields to go and get free lunch. They don't like it. They don't care what your ideology is. You got to work. They need your taxes. They need your this. They need your body doing that. So if only India, actually, in the Buddha's time, allowed that. The Chinese, absolute Confucius, no way. These guys who want to be ascetics, he was really down on them. And in West Asia, the time of, they had no such thing. The Desert Fathers, about 500 years later, began to go out. The ex-soldiers would go out in the desert, live in a cave. They were always dropout ascetics. But an institution for dropouts and a free lunch, nowhere except in India, because India was richest place, by far richest. That's really the reason. It isn't anything of special. Just it was the best economy. It was like California of the day. They had enough to have like free this and that. Sensible economy, surplus. And so Mahayana was built on the foundation of this social tolerance of these people seeking a higher evolutionary aim than just like living from birth to death in some routinized manner. So there's no opposition to it. In fact, when that individual vehicle became strong, what the Mahayana was outreach from there. It was going to people who were caught in the lay life and the lay responsibility, and who therefore were slaves, but helping them to combine with their wage slavery or their social, obligation slavery, whatever it was, combine some evolutionary development while without having to go all the way to the renunciant life. Because for some reason or another, they couldn't do it. So the Mahayana is actually an aggressive sign of the strength of the Theravada, actually. Do you follow me? Rather than a rejection of the Theravada, as you will read if you read books. People got sick of those monks, so then some monks ran out and pretended not to be monks. It's ridiculous. But, we always tell the story in our books in the Euro-American culture. We always tell the stories of other cultures that at some point in history, we conquered, maybe genocided half of, despoiled, robbed, and continue to suppress in a post-colonial manner, a neo-colonial economic manner. And we always tell their story that everything that happens to them is for the worse. It's always like Gibbon, decline and fall, They're always going worse because we have to see their history that way so that then when we come and rip them off, that was because they were already going down the drain, and we're progressive in helping them back up. I couldn't believe I read, I'm sick in Buddhism, never mind. There's a wonderful book called The Invention of the Americas by a man, a Mexican professor, which he wrote in protest to all the conferences in all the South American universities in 1992, celebrating 500 years since Columbus as a wonderful thing. And he wrote this book. It's just really something. But I don't want to digress, I'm sorry. So, now, the universal vehicle is based on having achieved some degree of transcendence, and then by transcending and therefore some degree of relief and happiness, feeling like some kind of amazing inner peace, feeling, you think, they thought, those arhats, that they were going to just flip out of the world and get to nirvana at some other place, and then they'd be in some permanent, like, stasis of bliss or something like that. They thought. But that didn't happen. But what happened was they got into a place where the inner self-centeredness became kind of hollowed out. They realized their selflessness, because that's the direction you go, in being more aware. And they realized, selflessness doesn't mean they didn't realize they didn't exist. It meant they realized they didn't exist in the way they thought they had existed. They existed in a relational way. They existed in a more free way. And so when they discovered that, they felt an inner peace and an inner bliss well up from within their hearts, and a kind of a peace that wasn't dependent on any object, like getting a benefit or a success in something or a possession or a food or a whatever it is, status, but it just came up right out of the nature of the world, because the world is basically abundantly full of energy for the open being that can feel the basic energy of life. And death, even life and through death. So life goes through death. Death is just a transition in life, like sleeping and waking, when you understand it that way, which more realistically, actually. And so then they felt better, you see. So then once they felt better, they became more critical in their thinking. and more reflective and more confident of their powers of reasoning and inference. And they began to realize, well, wait a minute, my old image of nirvana as a place outside the world that is sort of ultimate reality, and the world is just relative and irrelevant to it, and so I'm going to get to that place. But that fantasy that I had is an unrealistic fantasy actually itself, because if nirvana were a place different than the world, it would not be an ultimate place. It could, because it would be relative, because it would be boundaried, there would be a boundary between it and the world of suffering, and I would be leaving the world of suffering to go into it. And so therefore it would be a new thing for me to be there. And therefore it's like a, it would be like a heaven or like a place apart. It would sort of be made of causes. It would be that would relative, it would be relative. And it wouldn't be the permanent thing. You follow me? It wouldn't be the true nature of reality. It would be like an artificial reality somewhere else. So that image of nirvana was wrong. I only had that because I had an image of myself as separated from everything and frightened of it all. It's sort of feeling that it's after me. And after all, I've been an animal. I've been an antelope running away from crocodiles for billions of lifetimes. So I tend to, when I look up and see a lot of people, I feel nervous. Maybe they're going to do something to me. Because they have many lifetimes. They all ate me up a million times in different lives. I'm sorry. And you guys were like ferocious tigers. I was a little antelope. Of course, opposite, vice versa too. But don't worry. It's only one of me. And so that idea that there was something separate and safe that was my inner thing, then I projected that, oh, that's nirvana, where I'll go. And then they can't get me there, you follow me. That's security, you see. But that was just my fantasy because my imagination about my separated self, which is erroneous, actually, I've now discovered, because I'm empty of any such entity, and I am not such an entity, I'm a totally relational entity. And now I know that, and actually I find that instead of being threatening, that's a relief. So now I'm ready to understand it in a different way. But, and I might at first think, oh no, then there is no such thing as nirvana. There's just being resigned to this world. But then at least if you're resigned to this world, you're not trying to escape from it. And so then you sort of take it in stride with that resignation. Maybe that's what nirvana means. No, that's not what it means. It's much more interesting than that. That's what modern Buddhists tend to think. Oh, nirvana is when I'm just resigned to being like stuck in samsara. Go and cut some wood, draw some water, and I'm just here, and what the heck. That's what nirvana is. No, that's completely selling it short. Nirvana is permanent bliss, peace, complete, infinite, eternal, beyond all of this. And it is here now, actually, according to enlightened beings. Since it cannot be a place apart, since it is actual reality, ultimate reality, infinite reality, unmade, uncreated, unborn, but here, it therefore, it's here now. And therefore, when we achieving it is not a matter of going somewhere else, it's a matter of really understanding what is here now, fully. Not resigning to a misperceived here now where it's me versus the world and everybody's all separated and all kind of irrational things and there's a lot of nothings creeping around in which you might fall into if you get into the wrong singularity or something. But no, it's the actual fabric of all of this interwovenness is this nirvana. And my job is to become more and more realistic and more aware of it until I realize that's what this is. And when I do realize that that's what this is, when I remove myself the misrealization, the misunderstanding that this is something else, it will be an experience of something I always knew. Because it was not a new thing, in other words. I realized that I was always in touch with it, actually. I had built some sort of strange superstructure of not being where I was. Something like that. You follow me? And then that means other beings are also in it now, too. So that means that I and the other beings are really, when we really understand the world, we realize we are all totally interconnected with each other completely. There is no separation of ourselves from each other, which doesn't demolish our relational individuality necessarily, except whenever it's pleasant to do so temporarily. But it means that there's no real difference between us. You know, like I'm different. I, when I'm thinking of myself as the talking, yakking, thinking, you know, five senses sort of in my head or in my chest, different from my hand, but also that we are one thing too. My hand is part of me too. And when you feel like that about someone else, Well, that's when you realize that the situation is actually nirvanic and not samsaric. Strange as it may sound. So therefore, this then becomes this idea of the bodhisattva. Then this becomes the universal vehicle. It isn't really that you're saying, I'm going to be so nice and so great that I'm not going to seek my own liberation. And, you know, I'll postpone it and I'll just go and help others. That's sort of, it's put that way sometimes, and that's like a kind of altruistic and nice emotional way to put it. But it doesn't really work like that. What it works like is, I realize that I am the other people, and they are me. And so if their misery and my misery are empathetically intertwined, and therefore for me to really have freedom from suffering, they have to have freedom from suffering. And therefore we better acknowledge that we're in a universal vehicle. There is no other vehicle. You follow me? Universally, we're all in the same subway car. You know? This is the realization of. So it's very logical, therefore. You know, like in Western psychology, the messianic complex is considered a kind of dementia, right? Oh, you're going to save the world. Okay, here, have some Librium or Prozac or whatever. And calm down here. Go over there, that ward, and sit there next to Napoleon, Jesus, Josephine, and whoever. Because that's only logical, because someone says they're going to save the world, and actually you think they only have one life that they live, and their parents messed them up when they were little, and then they're going to drop dead and be nothing. There's no way to save the world. There's no time. The world is a huge, big, objective thing. You think, but you're thinking, so naturally that's crazy. But from the bodhisattva point of view, from the enlightened individual vehicle point of view, when you recognize your interwovenness with all life as a reality, not as a kind of, oh, it's so nice of me to be interwoven. As a reality, we are interwoven. It then becomes strictly logical, right? You follow me? Like here we are now, I always use this analogy, and some of you who are old friends have heard it many times, I apologize, but the new people, I've used this. We're here now in this room, you're listening to me at the moment, we talk sometimes, and then we leave and we never see each other, or maybe we come to another class or whatever. And so, you know, that's it. But if for any reason, in some circumstance, we were to become aware of the fact that we would never get away from each other. You know, you went there to this one class and then you discover you can never leave. And I went there to give one class and I discover I can never stop. And also I need to learn there for a lot of things from you. And then we become completely stuck together, so to speak. In the case of the vision of the Buddhist science, nature of reality, forever. But anyway, for a very long time, we will then have a very different attitude toward each other, right? Doesn't mean necessarily, we will realize that we won't be able to tolerate anybody being really freaked out, really angry with other people. We're all stuck together. I use the example of the mad scientist who takes a subway car full of New Yorkers who are in that space together with minimal mutual involvement as possible, all reading their book and newspaper to avoid looking at anybody else, not wanting anybody else to look at them, and looking behind them when they get off to make sure nobody follows them, and, you know, really freaked out and paranoid about each other. And that's the New York thing, right? Because you never see anybody in that car again. You sincerely hope. And suddenly, mad scientist takes that car and spirits it away and locks it up to watch an experiment and see how people's attitudes change when they're locked up together for potentially life. And they have to deal with each other. Then how do they change? Suddenly, you and everyone would become very important to you in that car. Maybe some you'd be worried would be enemies, or it would be crazy, or it would be a pest, so you'd want to avoid. Some would be friends, but you'd completely bond in a whole different way with them. And obviously the ultimate way, the optimal way of being with everyone in the subway car would be where everybody in the car was happy and contented. And everyone wanted you, and most important, they were so happy and contented, they all wanted you to be happy and contented. And so you had everyone else in the car wanting you to be happy and contented. You wanted all of them to be happy and contented because everyone wants everyone to be happy and contented. That's the optimal way of being. Could there anything be better than that? The opposite is our samsara. Each wants ourselves to be happy, and we're afraid if someone else is happy, they're going to take away ours. And so we don't want them to be happy. How happy do you want anybody you know to be? Think about it. Be honest. Your husband, your wife, your child comes in. I'm so happy. What did you drink? What did you take? Where have you been? You're merely freaked out, and you want to know what's wrong with them. And then, if you really believe that they're happy for all innocuous causes, you then feel jealous that you're not just as happy. Well, what about me, you say? What about me? Why aren't I happy like you? You didn't make me happy, you're just happy. And then, of course, you're like hell-bent to bring them down. So that's the pessimal way to be, where we are like that. No, therefore, no one lets anybody else be happy. They feel threatened by it. Right? But the optimal is everyone is happy.
Weekly interstitial music provided by Tenzin Chogyal. Used with the artist's permission, all rights reserved. To learn more, visit tenzinchogyal.com. This podcast was brought to you in part through the generous support of the Tibet House U.S. membership community and listeners like you. To learn more about the benefits of Tibet House membership, please visit tibethouse.us. For a complete listing of all upcoming events, please visit bobthurman.com. To learn about special intensive retreats and programs with Robert Thurman and friends at Menla, please visit menla.us, located just 2 hours north of New York City in the heart of the Catskills. Thank you for tuning in to this week's episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast. Please be sure to like and subscribe on iTunes and your favorite podcasting platforms.